The English period TV drama Downton Abbey premiered in 2010 and has developed a huge following. The events at Robert Crawley's estate, covering more than a decade, are seen by an estimated 120 million people globally. Through four seasons, Gillian Fellowes' creation has seen its share of tragedy, losing key characters, but it's also served as a kind of history lesson on how a home in the post-Edwardian era operates, with its family and servants during events like World War I. It's a kind of evening soap opera with touches of humor. I'm Jeff Bosser. Today on Focus, we'll have a recap of the season finale with Dave Quinn, TV critic for Entertainment Weekly, and we'll talk with Sharon Michalov, adjunct professor in medieval studies at the University of Illinois, to see how accurately the show depicts English life a century ago. Our program begins after this hour's news. Welcome to Focus, our morning talk program. I'm Jeff Bossert. Downton Abbey first premiered in September 2010 in the United Kingdom and Ireland. This fictional program depicting a wealthy estate in Yorkshire opens as the patriarch Robert Crawley of Grantham learns he's lost two cousins and heirs to his fortune with the sinking of the Titanic. We've gone through four seasons now. The season finale just aired last night on PBS stations. We've followed the family and their servants through the events of World War I, the Spanish influenza epidemic, and many other events. And within the home, a few characters have died. There's always something happening at Downton, whether it involves Crawley's daughter's love lives, operations of the family estate, or other gossips going on between the servants in the home. Joining us today on Focus to discuss the season finale and the first four seasons of Downton Abbey, Sharon Michalov, adjunct professor in medieval studies at the University of Illinois. She's here to talk about post-Edwardian life in the UK and historical lessons from the show. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
And for the first part of the program, we're going to talk a bit. Joining us by phone is Dave Quinn. He's a TV critic and hosts Entertainment Weekly's TV Recaps. Dave, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me, Jeff.
So let's recap the season finale. So this is a spoiler alert. If you don't want to, if you DVR'd it and haven't watched it yet, you might want to turn the radio down for a bit. But let's talk about the finale. This was a toned-down episode where we've had some shocking conclusions to seasons in the past. Characters have died. A couple of things are hanging in the balance here, but what do you take away from the season finale?
Well, I was surprised at how hopeful it was. Considering where the season started, you know, we had Matthew had just passed away, Mary and her son were abandoned, and in the first few episodes we had a horrifying rape of one of the characters, Anna. It felt like it was going to be a downer of a season. But with the arrival of Shirley MacLaine as Martha Levenston and Paul Giamatti as Harold Levenston, these American characters coming over to Downton, the entire feel of the finale actually was oddly American. And you can kind of look back in the season and recognize that there were all these glimmers of hope, this American dream, this future. Characters did very well for themselves, you know. Widowers who we've seen in the past now all of a sudden have this hope for love moving forward in the future. Lady Edith decided that she wanted to keep her baby. It's something very different than we've seen in the history of the show, and it was kind of exciting to watch.
Yeah, to me, the two real big mysteries or things hanging in the balance are who will Lady Mary end up with, you know, these couple of potential suitors there, and when the family will find out about Edith's child.
Well, right, and I'm sure those are kind of set up for next season of potential plot points of moving forward. But I think that in and of itself, what we've moved away from is this downside of Downton, right? You know, there's always been this concern of what would happen to the estate, a possible heir, how they are going to move forward. But Downton itself has this great future in farming. Mary seems kind of ready and poised to take over and to lead it to success, and she has these two suitors, Tony Gillingham and Charles Blake, that she's kind of choosing between, and it feels that progress is happening, which, you know, our historian on the line will have to talk a little bit more about, but feels very right for the time period.
We're talking about Downton Abbey and the season finale. Joining us for a bit on Focus is Dave Quinn, TV critic and host of Entertainment Weekly's TV Recaps. You can call us at 800-222-9455. You can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. You can also reach us on Facebook and Twitter. at Focus 580. So, Dave, were you a fan of the show from the start, or was this something you had to watch because this is what you do?
I got sucked in pretty early on, far before I was ever a part of Entertainment Weekly, and I think what kind of drew me to the show is really what drew so many people. It had this British costume drama mixed with this soapy plotting. And there were so many characters that there felt like there was a lot of different points of entry, right? There was always somebody that you could kind of relate to or root for. What I found really fascinating about the show, and what I still find so fascinating about it, is how it appeals to such a wide generation. You know, my mom watches Downton Abbey, and I watch Downton Abbey, and, you know, friends of mine and siblings and pretty much all across the generation board watches the show. And I think why we're also attracted to it is that it has this cultural protocol and etiquette, right, that these characters are in full swing of in the turn of the 20th century, and they really honor their place in society and thrive there. And what's so interesting is to watch these people who know their place and really find ways to succeed within that, within those boundaries, especially when we're in kind of a culture that doesn't really have that.
How soon will we have ratings for last night?
Oh, I don't know. I think ratings usually turn it over in the next day or so, especially because of PBS. But the show has really done very well. Just to kind of give a little bit of perspective here, Nielsen estimated that 15.5 million Americans watched the season 4 premiere last month. And that's higher ratings than, you know, mainstream hits like ABC Scandal, which only averages about 12 million viewers, or Elementary on CBS, which only averages about 14 million viewers.
So, well, does this kick some doors open for public broadcasting?
Well, it's definitely brought the public television broadcaster with the stodgy reputation over to the cool kids table, right? You know, there have been a lot of British crossovers in the past. The Avengers and Prisoner were massive hits in the 1960s, and other shows like The Office and Ab Fab to, you know, Flying Circus and The Benny Hill Show have all been crossovers. But it is the most successful show in the 40-year history of PBS's Masterpiece series. And I think more and more you see shows like Sherlock and the continued success of Doctor Who crossing into the American cultural conversation. And I really attain a lot of that to more social media. You know, I think the Twitter and the Facebook, putting a "the" before it makes it sound cool, right? But Twitter and Facebook has really spread this conversation across the pond, if you will.
Were we at a point where we needed a British period drama? I've not watched Upstairs, Downstairs, or some of these other things.
Sure.
Were audiences hungry for this kind of thing?
Well, you know, it's funny. I think that if there was a formula to how to succeed on television, then everybody would be doing it, right? It's hard to say whether it's that we needed this. Upstairs, Downstairs was a very big hit in the 1970s, and Downton pretty much follows the same soap opera formula, only with the action taking place, you know, in the country rather than in London like Upstairs, Downstairs was. But this is done better than that. And I think, it really resonates because of these universal themes of, you know, social status. It's also an unabashed romance. You know, we haven't seen this sort of romance on television in a long time. It's a show without violence or cursing. So it really leads itself to, family watching, and it leads itself to kind of crossing over, as I said, in the generations.
Well, and Downton's come along at a time when many are watching it on DVDs, as I do, and then or your Hulu or Amazon Prime or something like that.
Sure, the binge watching nature of the show has really helped it out. And as it's what I find really fascinating about it is the show airs over in England a couple of months before it ever airs in the U.S. and still, kind of everyone stays true to holding those spoilers away. it feels that the American audience, which has so much access to technology and can easily get these episodes if they need, still kind of wait to hold it and wait to experience it. But anybody can get into the show at any time. You know, it's really easy to marathon your way through four seasons of Downton Abbey over a weekend and be able to kind of start right around the time of the premiere. So long gone are the days where shows like Downton, or as we've seen Breaking Bad in the past, kind of decline in viewership as they go through the seasons. And this idea of, okay, well, you got your viewers from the get-go, and it's hard to kind of increase them. Now we see with DVRs and Netflix and all this binge-watching that more and more people are jumping into a show later on.
Is the next season truly the last one? Because Julian Fellowes,
yeah,
has managed to have waffled a bit on that.
You know, I don't know the answer myself. He seems to say that the show will be somewhere between 5 to 10 seasons, and no longer than that. You know, it's really rare for a British show to have multiple seasons like this. And he does all the work himself. He writes every episode himself. And I think that's really helped them maintain a quality of the show, because they've kept the production group so small, right? There's not this large group saying, the show should be like this, or the show should be like this. The networks have really trusted Fellows to do what he wants with it. I think we'll see another 2 to 3 seasons out of it.
I wanted to talk a moment about the humor in the show, because obviously there's a lot of dramatic things going on here, and the show is a backdrop to events in history, but a lot of great one-liners from Maggie Smith that you can find strung together on YouTube, and some other funny moments as well.
Yes, she's really brought a camp value to the show, which we all love. I thought she had some great moments last night, especially sparring with Shirley MacLaine's character, and she always kind of has a nice little sparring with Mrs. Crawley's character as well. She's really the thing that I think drives a lot of people to the show. I know she's one of the main reasons I watch as well.
I guess the other thing that just could impact the future, I mean, both the major deaths that we experienced, both actors wanted to leave the program.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Dan Stevens was not willing to have a plot line where he left for the U.S. or something like that in the next season. He wanted to leave, and audiences were stunned at the car accident that Matthew died in. But there was an article published by Entertainment Weekly talking, I saw yesterday, will the lords and ladies become movie stars? And because we've got Hugh Bonneville in The Monuments Men right now. Michelle Dockery's in a movie opening this next Friday. So I guess that's the only thing that could impact the plot if any other people say, nope, I want to leave and make movies.
Well, I think Fellows is kind of created himself a nice little world where that can happen. You know, Matthew's death was shocking for all of us, more so him. I think he had to write that episode and that death in pretty much at the last minute as they were on these contract negotiations. But because there are so many characters making up this world of Downton, the show can kind of afford to lose a couple of people here and there because you'd still have so many characters that make up the staff of the servants below and that make up the family itself. The other thing is, every season they seem to introduce, I don't know how they do it, but they seem to introduce 3 to 5 new characters and new storylines moving through. So it all of a sudden becomes, a turnover in the type of stories that you're telling. I find myself Googling a lot, even when I watch. Oh, who is that again? Oh, yeah, okay.
Yeah, I have trouble keeping track of characters. I usually remember, like, Maggie Smith said that, Elizabeth McGovern said that, rather than the character names. Just got a couple of minutes left with Dave Quinn, host of Entertainment Weekly's TV Recaps. If you have a question for him, 800-222-9455 or at will-talk@illinois.edu. What are you most looking forward to? We mentioned some plot points, but when we finally get to season 5?
Well, I was really intrigued last night. The final scene in the finale showed all the servants playing on the beach. And again, I felt like that was a very American way to send the season off. You know, it was very hopeful and fun and exciting. But there seemed to be this little bit of a spark between Carson and Mrs. Hughes. They held hands and kind of walked in the ocean, and you think maybe there's a little spark of love there that they could kind of explore. You know, the head butler and the head lady's maid kind of coming together. That would be really interesting to see. So I'm excited about that. I'm also really looking forward to see what Lady Edith kind of does moving forward. You know, she's now taken her baby and she's bringing it back to Downton and keeping it with farmers, Mr. Drew and his wife that are there on the Downton land. And it's going to be interesting to see how they play that story out. I really hope that her her baby daddy, if you will, returns next season, and we kind of find out where he's been and see how they decide to move that story. I'd really love a happy ending for her because she suffered so much.
Yes. Well,
punching bag.
Dave Quinn, TV critic and host of Entertainment Weekly's TV Recaps, thanks for joining us for part of the program today, and happy viewing.
Well, thank you so much, Jeff. Enjoy the rest of the conversation.
All right. Thank you. And again, your questions are welcome. We're talking about Downton Abbey. For the remainder of the program, we're going to turn to Sharon Michaelov, adjunct professor in medieval studies at the University of Illinois, to talk about some of the history portrayed in the show, how much is accurate, how much is brought along for dramatic effect. And Sharon, first I'd like to ask you a bit about, since we talk about medieval studies, some people might question how you know this period so well.
Most historians have to know more than, in my case, the 15th century. I was very interested in the Between the Wars period in England, in France, in Germany, and that led me to read a lot of fiction and a lot of social history and that kind of thing. So and also I do food history as one of my fields, and this is a really good period for food history. So. So I learned quite a bit about that kind of stuff, too.
Well, let's delve into what, before the show, we talked a little bit about what is realistic, what not so much. So one thing you pointed out to me, and I think is a treasured aspect of this show, is, first of all, you mentioned that there would not be nearly as many staff at Downton. We get to know people like Mr. Carson and Mrs. Hughes and Anna and Bates, but... if you were actually at a house in that period, they would just be kind of a face that you ignore when they're busy cleaning.
Right. There's not the exchanges. There's not the closeness between the servants and the family. The household staff actually would have been much bigger. There's not that many people living in the house, but the house is huge. And to think, you know, that you'd have a housemaid. Or possibly two housemaids. You know, you have a cook and a scullery maid, and you've got a lady's maid, and then of course once Anna becomes a lady's maid, then you've got more than one lady's maid. But you would have had upper and lower servants. So Carson and Mrs. Hughes would have been upper servants. Most of the others would have been lower servants. They would have. Eaten separately. They would have been served by the lower servants. You would see a different kind of meal for each group. So, you know, you tend to see the family meals, especially at entertainment. You know, they'll have these big, massive, there's this huge frenzy of cooking that goes on. The upper servants would have eaten better than the lower servants, for example. So you see the class distinctions played out all over. If you came down in the morning and there was a housemaid cleaning on the stairs, the maid would be expected to stand up and face the wall until you got all the way down the stairs and then go back to cleaning because they were supposed to be invisible. And it's interesting because if you go back and see some of the upstairs-downstairs episodes, there is somewhat more of that. Even though there's still these interactions between the family and the servants that are not always terribly realistic, but for some reason at Downton, you know, there's much more of a closeness. If you want to see fellows writing kind of a little more realistically about some of that, then Gosford Park would be more akin to what the relationship would have been than Downton Abbey.
And with some of the roles, I failed to mention jobs within the staff at the house, but I had mentioned Mrs. Hughes and Mr. Carson, kind of the heads down there. Mr. Carson, head butler, and Mrs. Hughes, housekeeper, maintaining mm-hmm. the female staff and maintaining the house's furnishings. Some of the other roles, something I printed up here, that you have cook or chef, lady's maid or valet or valet, as they say there, first footman, second footman, head nurse, footman, and chambermaids. It goes on and on throughout the hierarchy. But something we discussed for the show is something else that is not that was not seen often was the fact that they didn't hang on in a house in this period. They were looking to move on, as Alfred just did, going to with a job to the Ritz or other maybe higher paying positions.
Right. Well, you see some of that earlier on in the earlier seasons, where people kind of come and go a little more. Where the reality really hits home is when Mrs. Levinson comes, you know, without her lady's maid, because her lady's maid quit just before they left New York, and the reason was that Mrs. Levinson wasn't very nice to her. Well, this is not atypical, and there's a case of one woman who had 33 lady's maids in 34 years. So this says something about the servant family relationship, and the employers really did not see their servants as real people in a lot of cases. So there's a lot of uniformity. That's why the footmen have to, one of the reasons the footmen have to be tall. Everybody in a particular group has to have the same hairstyle, the same kind of uniform. They can't, so all the parlor maids have to wear the same kind of uniform. The ladies' maids wear something different from the parlor maids, but still they have to conform. And then there's this whole thing with names where frequently when a new servant comes into the household, they're given the name of the previous servant. So, you know, if you come in and your name is Stanley, you're still going to be William the footman. You're not going to be Stanley the footman. It makes it much easier for the family if they don't have to remember new names.
Well, and with names, the other issue is it's interesting what they call each other. And I don't know if this is more of a Downton Abbey thing or period then, if they did know anyone by name, but Mr. Carson is always Mrs. Carson. Mrs. Hughes is Mrs., but there's no sign that she is actually married to someone, and then some are just by their last name.
Well, frequently it's the last name. Because they're both upper servants, they would get this honorific. Usually after a certain age, especially with women in a position like Mrs. Hughes or the cook, for example, they would be Mrs. even if they had never been married. And that's just a convention of the time, where you wouldn't have said Miss, and there was no Ms. So you would automatically become Mrs. when you moved up in category or in age or that kind of thing. So
we had an email question earlier. Jack in Champaign says, Lady Grantham is the daughter of American millionaire Isidore Levinson, yet the series makes no mention of the Levinson's Jewish background. Is this because Julian Fellowes was unwilling to address British anti-Semitism at the time of the series?
Well, it's hard to say what Fellowes is trying to do, and he is trying to make this a series that's more palatable in a lot of ways, which is why we see these nice servant employer relations. This was a period where the monarchy had been very close to Jewish financiers. So the Rothschilds, for example, and some other families like that. So I don't think that he would have made a big deal about it. And it may be that in England they didn't worry as much about the names as we would. You know, it seems very obvious to us. But it's possible that where it could start coming in is now. Because what you're seeing now is one of the things we've now learned about Edith's friend is that he had an encounter with the brown shirts. And so there's a couple possibilities of things that could happen next season. I mean, he could actually be dead. He could actually come back as somebody who could report on the current conditions in Germany. And that would be an easy way to bring that kind of information into the series if they do that. But this is the period where you start to see some of the British aristocracy choosing sides.
We're talking about Downton Abbey this morning on Focus. I'm Jeff Bossert. You can call us at 800-222-9455 or email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. We're talking with U of I professor Sharon Michaeloff, a bit about the historical period and some of the customs of that time. I want to go to a clip now from the program, have my board operator bring up. We talked a bit about political happenings at the time and Tom Branson, the family chauffeur who ended up marrying Sybil, one of the characters we've lost in the show. This was a big confrontation, a scene of big confrontation in season two when daughter Sybil announces she's going to run off and marry the chauffeur, Tom Branson.
What do you mean you knew?
I hoped it would blow over. I didn't want to split the family when Sybil might still wake up.
And all the time you've been driving me about, bowing and scraping and seducing my daughter behind my back.
I don't bow and scrape. And I've not seduced anyone. Give your daughter some credit for knowing her own mind.
How dare you speak to me in that tone? You will leave at once.
Oh, Papa. Oh,
this is a folly. A ridiculous juvenile madness.
Sybil, what do you have in mind?
Mama, this is hardly...
No, she must have something in mind. Otherwise she wouldn't have summoned him here tonight.
Thank you, Granny. Yes, we do have a plan. Tom's got a job on a paper. I'll stay until after the wedding. I don't want to steal their thunder. But after that, I'll go to Dublin.
To live with him? Unmarried?
I'll live with his mother while the banns are read. And then we'll be married. And I'll get a job as a nurse.
What does your mother make of this?
If you must know, she thinks we're very foolish.
So at least we have something in common.
I won't allow it! I will not allow my daughter to throw away her life.
You can posture it all you like, Papa. It won't make any difference.
Oh, yes, it will.
How? I don't want any money. You can hardly lock me up until I die. I'll say goodnight. But I can promise you one thing. Tomorrow morning, nothing will have changed. Tom.
And that's a scene from Downton Abbey with several characters, but the main ones there... Robert Crawley, very upset about Sybil's plans to marry Tom Branson, who is a bit political, and that's been brought up again this season. He's Irish and has some beliefs that oppose that of the family for a while. But first question, Sharon, is does this happen often where you had an actual resident of the home marry a staff member?
No, not very often. You'd see it more in my period where widows would tend to marry... They're estate agents. So in the 15th century, you see that. You don't see it too much in the 20th.
But then the character of Tom Branson's an interesting one because he's a widower. Not long after his wife Sybil dies after childbirth, and then he talks about how he just does not belong there, and an interesting development in the show. But I don't know how real that is because he used to be a staff member and all the servants have to stand up when he walks in the room and that sort of thing.
Well, I mean, once he's a family member, then he's a family member. The servants have to treat him that way, even if the family isn't very good at it. There's a certain protocol. So and at the beginning, he would also like to circumvent the protocol, and over time he finds it somewhat... difficult, but also somewhat protective. And you see that when he's trying to deal with Thomas in the final episode from this season. So on the one hand, he feels that he owes a certain amount of explanation. And on the other hand, he's very irritated by this kind of weird condescension and all that kind of thing that's going on kind of in the background. But
and a little bit of political... happenings there because of his Irish upbringing and beliefs. And there was another incident earlier during their marriage when Sybil was pregnant, where she was left behind and they had to leave the rally separately to avoid facing arrest or being in some kind of trouble.
Yeah, no, it's the politics in the teens for the Irish was very hard, and actually it is right after the First World War too, because of course the Irish were actively working with the Germans and all kinds of things like that. So then you get this split right. So you've got the changeover, so that you've got the Irish Free State and you've got Northern Ireland still part of the Empire and all that. So things haven't really settled. In terms of the Irish, because they're neutral during the supposedly neutral during the war and all that. But it seems that his politics at this point are more socialist than they are than they are specifically Irish. And again, that can play up into the next season if Fellows decides to follow the politics of the period between the people who become Nazi supporters and the people who are socialists. And this is something you would see, for example, in the Mitford family, which is, you know, they're very well known, the Mitford sisters, and several of them were quite close to Hitler's. Particularly Unity and Jessica, who was the muckraking journalist who moved to the United States, was a communist, and you know.
If we have questions, if you have any questions about recent episodes of how relevant something was in actual history, having watched Downton Abbey for four seasons, you can contact us at 800-222-9455. We have a question emailed to us from Kathleen. She says, I was trying to identify the correct king for last night's episode. Was that George V and his Queen Mary? What can you tell us about the issues of that time and that monarchy?
Yeah, that was George V would have been the king, and the Prince of Wales was the future Edward VIII for the short amount of time that he reigned, and that's another theme that they seem to be bringing in now because he's rather prominent in the last episode, particularly where he leads the dancing at Rose's ball and all that kind of thing. George V was not very, had very, very high expectations for his sons, and he was always disappointed. And he was a very strict disciplinarian, and this, that comes out if you see the King's Speech, for example, where you have the future George VI who has this terrible stammer, and it's mostly because of the way that he was treated by his father, or at least that's one aspect of it. And the Prince of Wales is quite rebellious in the sense that he's very much more of a Edward VII as Prince of Wales figure. So he likes to have a good time and he likes to go to house parties and all that kind of thing. But the woman that he's with in these couple final episodes was his mistress until the early 1930s.
We're talking about Downton Abbey. We'd love to hear from you if you have a question about the historical aspect of the show or something about the most recent episodes. We're going to pause here for a short break. I'm Jeff Bossert. This is Focus. And we're back on Focus. I'm Jeff Bossert, talking about Downton Abbey in the first four seasons of the show with Sharon Michailov, adjunct professor in medieval studies at the University of Illinois. Someone tweeted to us, Jenna tweets at Focus 580, I like how they show people reacting to changing times on the show, like Mrs. Patmore and anything electric. I know Mrs. Patmore this season had an issue with the mixer. They also introduced the sewing machine recently on the show.
This is a big period for changes in technology, and it makes an enormous difference in food production, particularly. So you don't need as many people preparing things in the kitchen as you had before. You don't have to do everything with wire whisks and big spoons because you can start to use some of these more labor saving devices. Compared to what we have now, it's still not. If you've got a dinner party for 40 people, you still have to have people who can wash the dishes for 40 people and people to polish the silver before and clean it afterwards and put it away and all those things. That's why I said that really there's not enough staff there if they entertain on any large scale basis. But yeah, it does make a difference. Canned food is finally perceived as being a little safer. Canned food comes in the mid-19th century, and the canning processes are not always carried out very well, and they use lead solder in the tin. So if the lead solder leaks into the food, then you can get lead poisoning. And sometimes, one of the things they did on some of the – one of my interests is polar exploration, this big period for polar exploration. I know that sounds weird, but really, if you look at the period of Downton Abbey and then you look at what's going on there, Shackleton goes off in 1914 for his you know, his exploration and Scott in 1912, so 1911, 1912. So you've got these big British expeditions to try and claim the South Pole going on at the same time that, that all this is going on. And in fact, Shackleton has to get permission from the monarch to go instead of having him and his men all conscripted to go serve in the First World War. But canned food is coming in at this point. And so what you see is that the when the factories are producing cans for these expeditions, and it would have been the same kind of thing to produce stuff for the war effort or whatever, sometimes they would take shortcuts by making things in bigger cans. But then if they didn't process them well enough, then the food didn't get well processed, and then you would have spoiled meat and all these kinds of things. So there's big scandals in terms of some of the production of war materials and that kind of stuff. So technology kind of cuts both ways in this period, but certainly the radio's coming in and all kinds of things like that.
Well, that was something you brought up when we started talking, was food in that period. And they, I don't know if you're looking close enough to see what they're eating during the episodes of these, with the, well, we didn't have the staff actually there to prepare the dishes as they would have been then. Were they eating a lot of the things that, that you would expect, I wonder, at that
time?
Well,
I think to a certain extent they are. You know, and certainly a normal dinner for the family, everybody would have changed their clothes. So you would get up in the morning and you would get dressed, and then you would change your clothes in the afternoon, and then you would change your clothes in the evening for dinner, and dinner was very formal. And even after the First World War, you still have people are expected to change for dinner, and they might be wearing a regular tuxedo rather than a coat with tails and the whole thing, but still. So the meals for, you know, just a regular family dinner would still be maybe four or five courses, because you'd have an appetizer and you'd have soup and you'd have a main course with vegetables and all that, and you'd have dessert, and then you might have cheese afterwards. You might have some intermediary thing. If you were going to have a dinner party, you would need hors d'oeuvres, soup, fish, entree, removes, which would be kind of these, you know, like you might have a sorbet or something, meat, salad, savory, then you'd have some sorbet, dessert, and then you might still have cheese at the end. And then at the end of the meal, the women would all go off into the drawing room, and the coffee service would start, and the men would sit around and drink port. And we actually did this for a dinner in Oxford in the late 90s, where we were, so they had like four decanters of port. They didn't make the ladies leave, but we had to keep the port. You couldn't put it down. It had to keep circulating around the table, and we had these four decanters going around the table.
Gosh.
So, and we were almost all Americans, and so we weren't really drinking port, and we would get yelled at if we put the port down. So it was, so you can imagine what it would have been like with these men in there smoking and drinking port and the decanter constantly circulating until they finally got up to join the ladies.
Another commonly used term on the program is luncheon. Women mm-hmm. have lunch, and it gives you the vision, I guess, of like sort of more like a picnic or a lighter meal.
Yeah, usually. A lot of times it would be salad or something like that, because you would have had elevenses, which is kind of cake and coffee. And then so you'd have breakfast, then you'd have elevenses, then you'd have luncheon around 1. And then at 3:30 or so, you'd have tea. And then in this period after the war, at 5, you'd have cocktails. And then you would dress for dinner, and at 8 o'clock or so, you would have dinner. So you know, it's kind of like being on a cruise ship, with continuous food available. And so you wouldn't want all your meals to be heavy, and dinner was usually pretty heavy. So.
One of the big developments on the show we only really briefly touched on was World War One, and, of course, we had characters that had gone off. I mean, Matthew was injured and thought he wouldn't have the use of his legs again, and we lost another character. I want to go to a clip right now. This is as soldiers were recovering. This is between kind of an argument between the Dowager Countess, or Violet Crawley, and Robert's mother, or Maggie Smith, also Cora, and that being Elizabeth McGovern, about the use of a house as a convalescent home for wounded soldiers.
I think it's a ridiculous idea.
Why?
Because this is a house, not a hospital.
But, Granny, a convalescent home is where people rest and recuperate.
But if there are relapses, what then? Amputation in the dining room? Resuscitation in the pantry?
It would certainly be the most tremendous disturbance if you knew how chaotic things are as it is.
But when there's so much good can be done. I forbid it. To have strange men prodding and prying around the house. To say nothing of pocketing the spoons. It's out of the question.
I hesitate to remind you, but this is my house now. Robert's in mine, and we will make the decision.
Oh, I see. So now I'm an outsider who need not be consulted.
Since you put it like that, yes.
And again, a scene there talking about the aftermath of World War One. And you told me earlier, that's really interesting. So Highclere Castle, which is what the home is actually called, and where much of the home, much of the program is shot, was actually used in that for that function.
Yes, it was set up as a hospital. One of the things that happens at the beginning of the First World War, we frequently see these kinds of scenes where everybody, all the men, want to get into the war before it ends because they think it'll be over in 6 weeks, and so all these men go off bringing all their estate laborers with them, or half their village, or whatever. But the women were just as enthusiastic and wanted to have a role. So what happens with a lot of these houses is that they're turned into hospitals, and they want to buy the best equipment. There's X-ray machines and all kinds of things like that. They're not so worried about the convalescent as they are the actual hospital. And then they start competing for patients. Now, you have to remember that for the most part, these are set up for officers. These are not set up for the average enlisted man. So they're going to be probably, upper middle class and up. So you're not going to get, somebody from the London slums who's staying at your house. And then they start setting up these hospitals in France and battlefield hospitals. And these women train as nurses, and they volunteer as VADs, which are these kind of volunteer aides, and do all kinds of things like that. So it's this really fervent patriotism that's driving this. So it's possible that somebody like Violet, who's very she's very Victorian. I mean, she's not Edwardian. She's very Victorian. Might not like the idea too much, but certainly Cora would not have been kind of waffling back and forth. And Highclere had like 20 beds in 1914, so pretty early on in the proceedings. So, yeah, no, there was no argument about this. Lots of this went on all over.
Talk about differences between the Edwardian and Victorian periods.
Well, one of the things is that you feel like you have a lot of etiquette through this whole thing, but really the Victorians were very, very, they had lots of rules. So one aspect you can look at is mourning, for example. So in the Victorian period, if you were a widow, we always see Victoria after Albert dies wearing black forever. Widows were pretty much supposed to wear black. By the time you get into the Edwardian period, then there's the period of deep mourning where you wear black, and then you go into half mourning after 2 years, and you can wear half black. And by the time you get to the period after the First World War, then the all-black period may only be 6 months. You probably wouldn't have to wear crepe on all your garments and these long veils. And after a few months, you would kind of move into black and lavender, or you would start adding some white to your outfit or something like that. So one of the things that happens when Victoria dies in 1901 and Edward VII becomes king is that you start to see some relaxation of the rules. Not it's not casual like now, but even the period of the flappers was not casual like it is now. But definitely the rule the society sanctions for things are slowly easing up quite a bit.
We're talking about Downton Abbey and with U of I professor Sharon Mikhailov. And if you want to write us at will, you can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu or at 800-222-9455. So when they changed the clothes so often, was this at all related to hygiene, or was it merely just this is what's expected of you in this period?
It's what's expected of you in this period, and it also shows that you can afford all these clothes. So part of all of this all the time is showing your place in society, showing your place in the world, showing how much money you have. And this is a real problem for a lot of these estates because over time, because of taxation, because of mismanagement, because of all sorts of reasons, divisions of the estates, you have less and less money. So you might have lots and lots of land. You might have lots and lots of stuff. So, you know, if your family's been around for 400 years, you might have all kinds of wonderful family portraits and lots of great Dresden china and all kinds of things like that. But that's not cash. But in the meantime, you know, your wife wants to go to Paris every year and order dresses from Worth and that kind of thing. So it's a huge problem because you have to keep up the appearance. This is one reason, and this is something that they have from the beginning of the series, which is Robert's marriage to Cora. In the late 19th century, when this is really going on, you could actually get guides to American heiresses. You could get guides to the British aristocracy so that these American heiresses would know who to marry, and these British aristocrats would know which American heiresses had the most money so that you could make these marriages. And there's lots of them. They don't always work out very well, but it is a way of bringing money into the estate. So, you know, Consuelo Vanderbilt, for example, who's married to the Duke of Marlborough, they separate. Jenny Churchill doesn't do well with Randolph particularly, but you do see lots and lots of these, and there have been some PBS costume dramas about those kinds of marriages as well.
I think it's interesting that even for more than a couple of seasons now, we've been talking about the operations of the estate and all the farm properties, and now now Tom and Lady Mary are sort of at the forefront of that, and we had a fun little moment with pigs last season, and it's nice to see Tom kind of actually having a voice in all that and not just being in the background as this poor, you know, this former chauffeur.
Well, I think it plays into his background to a certain extent. You know, he's from an Irish family. They probably lived on the land, and or at least some of them, and you know, it's a place where he can fit in better because the estate managers are not usually kind of the upper aristocrats either. They're more likely to be the gentry, the upper gentry, that kind of thing. So it's a world he can fit into better. But I mean, this whole thing that goes on with the idea that Charles Blake is talking about of the families that are just selling off pieces of their land and all of that, that's very much what's going on. And over this period, taxes are going up quite a lot. Death duties are going up quite a lot, which means that if you have a bunch of deaths, which is one of the things that happens, you know, with the First World War. So the Lord dies, maybe of old age, maybe not. The heir dies. Then you have the subsidiary heir, maybe another son, maybe a cousin, whatever. They die. Every single time somebody dies, they have to pay these death duties over again. So what you see over time is they start selling off parts of the estate. They start opening up the estate to the public. They start selling off their pictures and their ornaments and things like that. So this is very common in this period. And a lot of the upper aristocracy knows nothing about farming, and if they have a really good manager, that's great. And if they don't have a really good manager, they can be robbed blind, or the land may just not be put to very good use. It's kind of like the whole idea of the pig man who goes off and doesn't pay attention to the fact that the pigs have no water. And that doesn't seem very realistic that, you know, you'd hire somebody who's a specialist on pigs and have that happen. But, you know, who knows? It leads to a dramatic scene.
Right. We had a tweet from Nancy. This is more about the show, not so much about. But they said, I thought the season was too much about family soap opera and too little about historical context. And maybe we mentioned earlier in the show, maybe Julian Fellowes felt like he had some making up to do with tragedies and just. I don't know what your thoughts were about that.
Well, I think it was a recovery season to a certain extent. So it's not. And essentially, they're kind of in this period where they're throwing in some historical stuff, but it's not as dramatic. If they get in, depending on where he starts next season, if they end up in, say, 25, 26, then you're going to have the big general strike and all these kinds of things. So he's got places he could go with that if he wants to go with more history. But, you know, a lot of outcry about these characters dying, and maybe he felt he needed to kind of focus on what was left of the family at this point.
Yeah, it is interesting. We've got to wrap this up. But how much he has been able to cover, Julian Fellowes has been covered in about a decade of time in this show. Mm. We want to thank you so much for coming in. Again, Sharon, Michael Love, she's an adjunct professor in medieval studies at the University of Illinois. We've been talking about Downton Abbey's first four seasons. Thanks so much for coming in today.
Well, thanks so much for having me, Jeff. I appreciate it.
And we want to thank Dave Quinn. He's a TV critic and hosts Entertainment Weekly's TV Recaps. He joined us earlier in the program. If you have any additional thoughts about today's program, you can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. Today's show was produced by Lindsay Moon. Jason Croft was our technical director. And tomorrow on the show, we'll have Kristen Williamson, Republican candidate for Illinois' 103rd House seat. In the second half, Illinois Public Radio's Brian Mackey and Tom Kasich of the News Gazette will talk about other races in the area. I'm Jeff Bossert. This is Focus.